uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. This is the Wednesday edition of the broadcast, June 20th, 2012, into June the 21st, 2012. Thank you so much for being with us here tonight for another late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast. No live show last night because of lack of material, as I've been talking about so much lately, and again tonight. Only a small amount of news to get into with you here tonight. And, you know, I don't know. You know, you always see dips and cycles in, you know, dips in various times in the news cycle when it's slower. But certainly during an election year when a lot of the election stuff is going on, media resources never are focusing on that because that's what they want you focused on. So, of course, whatever they want you focused on is what is going to be getting the largest amount of press. And I guess since I flat refuse to, I mean, what else can I say, man? You know, really? Is it going to further the quest for knowledge if I get up here and talk about the phony fucking elections every night of the week? No, but I guarantee you there are shows out there right now that call themselves conspiracy or truth shows or shit like that that are probably doing that. And I just refuse to get involved in that crap-tacular spectacle and even discuss it because, again, you know, if you don't know by now that shit's phony, if you don't know by now that that's fake and a distraction and by no means gives you any kind of a say in a goddamn thing, you know, if you don't know that by now and you're here listening to my show, you probably need to quit listening to my show and go back and listen to, you know, I mean, because, please. You know, the whole thing is completely staged. These choices are given to us, and they're both sides of the same coin. I don't know what else to say about that. So, but I also it also does make me wonder if they're planning something. You generally see these kind of lulls right before something big happens, because why? Well, when there's not a big story. But we do have things like the Olympics coming up as well. A lot of resources are going to that. So it is strange, but I just, you know, I always go with my gut feeling when it comes to this stuff. Adjust my mic there. There we go. But I always go with my gut feeling on this stuff. My gut feeling here just tells me that, you know, they're up to something. They're planning something big, I think, this summer. I could be wrong about that. I hate making predictions, but sometimes a lot of times I'm right about them. I don't know. There's something cooking, that's for sure. My website where this broadcast originates from is theglobalreality.com. That's theglobalreality.com. You'll find all things pertaining to your work up there. I want to give a special thanks to one of our listeners. He didn't really give me, I'm trying to see what his, Blistered, I guess, is his name. That's what it says in his email. Blistered. So, Blistered, you know who you are. He actually has created a nice new website theme for us that I sent over to our webmaster, Man Hydra. And it's really cool. I like it. It's as it stands right now, the website kind of has all that blank space on both sides of the screen. And now, you know, well, I guess a few years ago, not everything had gone widescreen. There wasn't really iPads and all that stuff yet. So, but if you're looking at it on a widescreen, you know, you've got all this gap space on both sides. Well, that's all going to be gone. He's got like a picture of Toth and some different things. It just looks really cool, and I really like it. So looking forward to seeing that up live on the website real soon. We'll have a new design, new looking. It won't look radically different, but it'll. I think it's an improvement, and definitely looks a lot slicker to me. You know, it's kind of what I've kind of wanted for a long time. Although what I really want is, you know, a slick flash site with fucking shit popping out at you, and you know, pictures and stuff like that. That's what I'd love to have. But wanting one hand shit in the other is kind of what I've learned to do around here. Anyway, thanks for joining us. TheGlobalReality.com. It's TheGlobalReality.com. We have just a few hours left. About 21, to be exact. 21 hours left from right now. Left on our emergency film budget. Please help us chip in and help us get our reach our goal there for the film. I went through on Monday night show some various dollar amount donation packages that you're going to get. I'm not going to do that again for the sake of time of the show. So if you're curious about that, because we've got what we're doing here is for anybody that helps us from now till the next 21 hours, we've got some special deals going on for different amounts for different donations that we're going to have there. But I mean, anything $50 or above is going to get you, you know, a signed copy of the film when it's done. And now, so that alone right there to me is worth, you know, because you're gonna get it first, so you'll get yours before anybody else does. So there you go. And plus Monday night I went over some of the other different ones, so you can go back and listen to that and hear the different things. It's going to be pretty much the same for our Kickstarter as well. One of our listeners is working on trying to get a Kickstarter thing going for us. Hopefully that's going to happen. He's been working trying to get it going, and I guess he's had some problems with the account, bank account thing you got to do through Amazon or something like that. But he's working on that, and hopefully that'll be up soon. Hopefully that'll at least expose it to, you know, maybe a resource pool outside of my show. You know what I mean? Which is really what I really need. That's the biggest thing that we need help with. So hopefully that's gonna go through. But I just, man, I continue to research, continue to find more and more stuff. Still mapping out everything that's going to be in the film, the script and stuff. But it's pretty much come together. Like I said, the only thing I'm really missing now is I'm just missing more footage that I need to go out and shoot. And without a budget to do that, and with, you know, I need some more gear upgrades as well. New high def camera, a real good pro high def camera, things like that. That's only going to increase in how much gear we're going to need. New gear we're going to need once we start doing the dig as well. Once we get to that, but we got to get this volume one out first before we get to the volume two, which will comprise the dig and more information. But it's fascinating stuff. Me and Man Hydra were talking about some stuff in the chat room last night. God, it's mind blowing. And I've come to the conclusion on something I'll share with you here. After extensive research and extensive going over the pre-existing data concerning the ancient mysterious rock wall in Rockwall, Texas, I don't believe any of the previous dating attempts, nor do I believe any further dating attempts, more accurate pertaining to the wall. I don't believe Dr. Wolf Goss from the University of Texas findings of 50 to 55 million years are correct, and I'll tell you why. Once I found out about this quarry, once I found out about Beringer Hill, and we've got a news story tonight that kind of ties in with that as far as rare earth metals and stuff we'll get into tonight when we get into the news here in a bit. But once this information about the, you know, because I was coming from the standpoint from my, you know, research into this, because I come at these, when I'm researching something, I come at it from a lot of different angles. You know, I try to make sure that all my bases are covered and I'm looking at it from every possible angle I can, and that's what I find what fits and what doesn't, and then I go after what doesn't to try and look further into it. And that's what led me to finding out about this Beringer Hill thing. I mean, you know, the walls are primarily composed of zircon. Zircon's the most abundant mineral at Beringer Hill. There was evidence of mining going on way back in antiquity there. And it was buried under a lake, just like all these other sites, rock wall and on and on and on. And come to find out, you know, here's the thing. If the reason why it's almost impossible to get any accurate dating on how the wall is and why I don't believe any of the dating has been done so far on it is accurate is because the dating that's being done is being done with the assumption, because this is Dr. Wolf Goss's assumption. He was coming from, okay, he goes and looks like, okay, here, what am I going to do a survey of, a paleomagnetic survey of this rock wall thing? Okay, what's he do? He's, you know, a professor, University of Texas, very respected, right? Mainstream scientist, right? So he goes and checks out, like any scientist would do, the pre-existing data on the rock wall, correct? He goes and checks out the pre-existing data on the rock wall, which, by the way, I have the evidence of, absolute dead, hard evidence of to be false. But he goes and looks at that scientific evidence, which, again, is from 1933, by the way. It's funny how many scientific things that are just held as established fact have never been challenged by anybody, even though there's evidence to challenge them. And so Wolf Goss is basing his assumption when he does this paleomagnetic survey. He's coming from the standpoint that it's a natural formation. So 50 to 55 million years for a rock formation is, you know, that's pretty spot on, you know. We can see in other rock formations and stuff, but that time period for geologic activity and volcanic activity and whatnot, certain areas, that's spot on. But here's what it doesn't factor in. Here's what makes that dating or any accurate dating of the wall itself almost impossible. I wouldn't say it makes it totally impossible. I would say it makes it almost impossible. Is because the data that these stones were quarried and created, hand created, there's absolutely no doubt they were. There's never been any rocks anywhere on Earth that have ever been found comprised of these materials, and especially with the buttering of the stones done with geopolymers and the rocks comprising all these different rare earth minerals. They were mixed together as a mason would do, and they were built with into masonry walls. But because the material that they were comprised of and been brought together from different sources from were, when that rock formed, it formed, you know, 55 million years ago. So when he's doing the paleomagnetic survey on this wall, he's getting the signature of when these rocks were formed, which is 50 to 55 million years ago. Now, that's when the rocks were formed. That has nothing to do at all with how old the rock wall structure is. Now, again, if you say, if you come from the standpoint you believe it's a natural formation, then coming and saying 50 to 55 million years, okay, it's a natural formation. It's how old? 55 million years? Oh, okay. Well, that's normal. That's, you know, that's par for the course. Next. It's only when you have the information that these stones, and I'm not aware that Wolf Goss had that information or not. I don't know for sure. I do know he won't publish his findings, whatever the other stuff he found, till after he's dead. But that date of 55 million years of the rock and when the rock was formed has nothing to do with when that stuff was quarried, mixed together, made into those stones. Now, to me, some of the biggest evidence is things like the iron wheels that were found in there, because that's absolutely classic for these amorites that I've been speaking of. that, I mean, that kind of metal smelting about 7,000 years ago or so is very accurate to the time in which they were here. But that metal wheel's at such a high height in the wall. That's where it was found. That, I mean, there's so much below that that's older. The biggest thing is as I've stated from the get-go, is that we just, because no one's ever gone all the way down, and no one's ever excavated multiple sections at a time, the amount of data we have to make judgments on whether or not it's natural or unnatural have not been allowed to us. Because, again, these original scientific, when the scientific community came out and... I posted a picture of it not too long ago. Give me a second here, and I'll read just to find it, and I'll read to you what this looks like. It was taken from a book, but it's a picture. I put in the chat. It's an old man standing there. It's on the Global Reality Facebook page. But here's what it says. It says, during the second half of the 20th century, scientists continued to study the rock wall formation and debate its origins. In 1979, Dr. Kenneth Scharr of the University of Texas at Arlington examined two sections of the wall and concluded that both were natural formations, but he did not rule out the possibility that another portion could be man-made. So right there is a clear indicator that my assumption about this is correct. We're dealing with two different phenomenons here. And because the natural formations are within the wall structure itself, but are not the actual wall that goes around it, but right in the middle of it, that proves right there that what the scientific community has looked at has been these natural formations which exist inside the wall. And, of course, I have the map that I got from the Rockwell Historical Society that shows these. But it says right here, that the portion of the rock wall that was excavated was on land near Farm to Market Road 549 and Cornelius Road. Now, you can go look that up yourself, 549 Cornelius Road. You can probably put that into into Google Maps and find that yourself. But and if you have the map overlay, which you can probably find on online somewhere, or I mean, you just type rock wall, ancient rock wall map, it'll probably come up. It's like a pink thing. But you can see for yourself right there that if you go look up where Farm to Market Road 549 and Cornelius Road is, because when I first saw this, I was like, oh shit, you know, this is huge. This is going to tell me, you know, where this site was that these excavations were done, where the scientific community said it was natural. And lo and behold, 549 Cornelius Road is almost dead center, ladies and gentlemen, in the middle of the wall itself. Very far away from any of the perimeter. It's in the middle. Imagine if you had a rectangle, right? Let's say if you draw a rectangle on a piece of paper and then take a dot and put a dot right in the center of the rectangle, okay? And that would be where this dig site is at 549 and Cornelius Road, where the scientific community based their opinion that it was a natural formation on. And like I said, when that was done, they didn't have the benefit of these NASA satellite images that we have now. But because no one has gone to the scientific community, and this is what I'm attempting to do with this film, no one has gone to the scientific community and said, look, you need to change this. It is a mistake, and it is wrong to say that this is a natural formation, when what that's being based on of is information that was prior to there being available Landsat images, which we have now. So that right there, when I was able to find the actual location address, because I know where FM 549 is. I mean, everybody does. Around here, 549 Cornelius Road, that's off Highway 66. Well, Highway 66 runs through the middle of Rockwall. it in no way, shape, or form is anywhere near the top, bottom, left, or right perimeters of this wall. So again, there was definitely some stuff going on around what it was almost as if they built this as a perimeter around these areas for whatever reason, utilizing them for their own purposes. But it's fascinating stuff. And my thing about it is that I mean the scientific community has to change their standpoint on this, and if they won't, I'm going to bully them into it. Because I'm going to start me an exploratory mining company, and I'm going to go say that I'm going to start exploring for rare earth minerals in Rockwall, Texas, because I know for a fact some are there. They're like, well, how do you know there's even any here? We've never heard of there being rare earth metals in Rockwall. Well, no, there actually is. Oh, really? Where at? Well, the ancient mysterious rock wall there is chock full of these rare earth minerals. And you guys say it's a natural formation. That's what scientific community says, right? It's just a, you know, prehistoric sand dike. So I'm going to start me an exploratory mining company, and we're going to see if we can find a significant amount of rare earth metals in Rockwall County. And if we can, we're going to dig a bunch of them up and take them and have them processed. We're going to get us some cash. And they're going to, and then what's going to happen? Oh, you can't do that. No. You can't do that. Oh, you can't do that. Right? City of Rockwall probably all up in arms trying to stop us. No, you can't do that. Why can't I? Scientific community says this is a natural formation. This isn't anything special worth preserving. This isn't some ancient wall built some, right? That's what you guys believe. That's what you're telling everybody. Somebody comes to Rockwall and asks about the Rockwall. What do you tell them? Natural formation, right? Well, we want to take this natural formation, and we want to capitalize on the fact that China's running out of rare earth metals, and anybody getting into the rare earth mining business right now is going to make some skrilla. And watch these motherfuckers squirm like cockroaches with the lights on. I'm going to put these motherfuckers in a corner. I got them. They don't even know it. I got them 8 ways to Sunday on this. I got you on the information front. I've proven you to be liars, and I'm going to get you on the front of your story as well, because I'm going to hold you to your bullshit. You mark my words. China's rare earth reserves account for approximately 23% of the world's total, but are being excessively exploited, the Chinese government has said. Although 23% is a high percentage for one nation to possess, China supplies over 90% of rare earth products on the global market. We need the raw materials, chemicals such as yttrium, which is in huge supplies down there at Beringer Hill in Lake Buchanan. Why don't we go get that? Again, you can go look up Beringer Hill. Go look up the Wikipedia for it. It'll say right there, one of the single largest supplies of rare earth metals ever found on Earth. And yes, yttrium is one of them, which is used in TVs, lanthanum, used for camera lenses, and modern tools we use every day. I mean, literally, folks, a cash cow signature. Why is it covered up? Why is it under a lake? Why did they bury it under a lake? Because evidence. Evidence. If you uncover Beringer Hill, you are going to uncover along with it the evidence of mining going on there, which we already know. That's why they covered it up. You can go look at the pictures. Big chunks and blocks of the exact minerals used in the rock wall quarried out of it. 288,000 cubic yards or something that they claim tourists just carried out in their pockets through the years. Nice try, guys. Nice try. Those pesky tourists. Yeah, 288,000 cubic yards. And see, again, this is another place. This is another place I'm going to catch them in a fucking pickle. I'm going to scream and yell about this till the cows come home. If we need rare earth metals so bad, and if China's running out so bad, and they're jacking the prices up where we can't be able to make anything, then why don't we drain out a little part of Lake Buchanan and go down there and get ourselves some rare earth metals? Because I'm telling you what, you know, If I find some people that want to invest in this kind of thing, there's literally billions, maybe even trillions to be made if you could do it. Literally. I'm not talking about a little bit of cash here, folks. And at the same time, and I don't even give a damn about the money, you can start the fucking rare earth metals thing if you want, and you can keep 100% of the profits. All I want is to be there when it's drained out so I can get video and pictures so I can have my evidence to prove this is the quarry. You can make all the money off of it. Yeah, you want to kick me a mill or two for, you know, tipping you off to the information. Hey, I'm down with that, but you know, I'm in this strictly for the for the information and the science. But hey, you know, information can make you money in the right situation, and that's what it seems like. I've been yelling about this and giving people information about this. Nobody's listening. But again, here's another news story about it today. This runs the risk that if China starts reducing its output, we may see spiraling prices for our modern accessories, or even simply be able to produce them in the first place. Not be able to produce them in the first place. Terrible, terrible writing as per usual here. According to the white paper titled Situation and Policies of China's Rare Earth Industry, the country has paid a big price for problems in its rare earth industry like excessive exploitation, environmental damages, unhealthy industrial structure, underrated prices, and rampant smuggling. China has seen rare earth reserves keep declining in major mining areas, with a reserve extraction ratio of ion absorption rare earth mines in southern provinces slumping to 15 from 50 two decades ago, the white paper said. In North China's Baotou City, only one-third of the original volume of rare earth resources is still available in the main mining areas. Meanwhile, outdated production processes and techniques have severely damaged the environment, the white paper said, noting that excessive mining has resulted in landslides and pollution emergencies and even major disasters in some places. Besides, the industry is also plagued by overcapacity in low-end product manufacturing and the fact that prices of rare earth products fail to reflect their value and scarcity despite a gradual rise since the second half of 2010, according to the white paper. Rising demand for rare earth products has fueled smuggling, with the volume of rare earth products imported from China calculated by foreign customs reaching 1.2 times the export volume counted by the Chinese customs in 2011. China is the world's largest producer of rare earths, a group of 17 metals vital for manufacturing products ranging from smartphones, wind turbines, electric car batteries, and missiles. Scandium, yttrium, lanthanum, cerium, praseodymium, neodymium, promethium, samarium, europium, gandolium, a lot of these are found in Beringer Hill. Terbium, dysprosium, holmium, erbium, thulium, ytterbium, and lutium. So there you go. Well, this makes me wonder if they've got some kind of, ancient extraterrestrial craft firing up in ancient Mesopotamia again. Anybody wonder why we would be sending a new significant military presence to Kuwait all of a sudden? I thought everything was all clear there. Something's going on here. I smell an antiquities hunt again, as per usual. The United States is planning a significant military presence of 13,500 troops in Kuwait to give it the flexibility to respond to sudden conflicts in the region, such as Iraq, just to the withdrawal of American combat forces. No, they're staging troops there for when they get ready to going to Syria and Iran and all that. I want to have some backup, man. It's going to get ugly. But we had such a presence there for so long, and now they're being a new presence there. Definitely smell that they're looking for something. No surprise here, right? I was talking about this a year ago, I think it was, with Stuxnet and all that. And had, you know, we were smelling Mossad footprints all over that motherfucker. The United States and Israel jointly developed a sophisticated computer virus nicknamed Flame that collected critical intelligence in preparation for cyber sabotage attacks aimed at slowing Iran's ability to develop a nuclear weapon, according to Western officials with the knowledge of the effort. The massive piece of malware was designed to secretly map Iran's computer networks and monitor the computers of Iranian officials, sending back a steady stream of intelligence used to enable an ongoing cyber warfare campaign, according to the officials. Yesterday's conspiracy theory is today's fact. Yet again, the effort involving the National Security Agency, the CIA, and Israel's military has included the use of destructive software such as the so-called Stuxnet virus to cause malfunctions in Iran's nuclear enrichment equipment. The emerging details about Flame provide new clues about what is believed to be the first sustained campaign of cyber sabotage against an adversary of the United States. That they've admitted to, right? I mean, these guys hired all the best hackers, started hiring all the best hackers years ago, man. You wouldn't believe how many of the top hackers out there are working for government agencies. I mean, that's kind of the thing among hackers. It's what they all hope to be able to do eventually. Not all of them, you know, some of them don't give a fuck about the government, but Texas A&M University in Texas here has won a big federal biodefense contract. Now, they already do all kinds of bioweapons, genetic engineering. I mean, they do some crazy shit down there, and that's why there's been an outbreak of these strange genetic manipulated creatures around that area. But it seems now they're actually going to be working on, you know, the bioweapons. And if there is another major pandemic outbreak, you can bet your bottom dollar this is going to be a prime location where it's going to be coming from. A friend of mine's dad went to A&M University, and he went to, he was there with, like, people like, what was the guy, the Sirianni guy, the Robert Gates. And I said to my friend's dad one time, I said, hey, you went to A&M, huh? So, yeah, they're the biggest, number one most recruited school in the world from by the CIA. And he said, yeah, you're exactly right. Didn't deny it one bit. I'm like, yeah, you know, some people would call me a conspiracy theorist for saying that. He said, oh, no, you're not a conspiracy theorist. That's just fact. That's the way it is. That's Spook University right there, man. The Texas A&M University system has been awarded one of three national biodefense contracts to help the country quickly develop vaccines in the event of a pandemic, and also strategies for responding to bioterrorism. So, in other words, they're going to be working with live viruses, oops, oh, wow, we dropped a test tube, and now half of Texas needs to be quarantined. Oops, our bad. I just don't like it. An archaeologist says he found the oldest piece of rock art in Australia and one of the oldest in the world. An Aboriginal work created 28,000 years ago in an outback cave. The dating of one of the thousands of images in the Northern Territory rock shelter known as Nawarla Gamaharmang will be published in the next edition of the Journal of Archaeological Science. University of Southern Queensland archaeologist Bryce Barker said Monday that he found the rock in June last year, but only recently had it dated at New Zealand's University of Waikato Radiocarbon Laboratory. He said the rock art was made with charcoal, so radiocarbon dating could be used to determine its age. Most rock art is made with mineral paint, so its age cannot be accurately measured. It's the oldest unequivocally dated rock art in Australia and among the oldest in the world. Continue to push it back, don't they? They know what's coming. They know what's coming. You motherfuckers are scared. Yeah, let's slowly go and push this back before Reeves gets his movie done, just so it's not as that big of a shock. Yep, here, you know, every week now, hadn't it been 10,000? Yeah, here's some older. We got some even older rock art. Boy, they just seem to be finding, I mean, somebody's looking hard at rock art lately, isn't it? I mean, for years we didn't give a fuck about that, right? All of a sudden, every week, oh, no, you didn't find the oldest rock art. I did. I found one that's older. I found one that's 28,000 years old. Look at that. But I thought the world's only 10,000 years old, and Jesus made the world in 10,000 10,000 years ago, right? Praise the Lord. Well, I don't know. Still don't know how they rationalize that one. The kinds of drones making the headlines daily are the heavily armored CIA and U.S. Army vehicles, which routinely strike targets in Pakistan, killing terrorists and innocents alike. But the real high-tech story of surveillance drones is going on at a much smaller level, as tiny remote-controlled vehicles based on insects are already likely being deployed. Over recent years, a range of miniature drones or micro-air vehicles based on the same physics used by flying insects have been presented to the public. The fear kicked off in 2007 when reports of bizarre flying objects hovering above any war protesters sparked accusations that the U.S. government was accused of secretly developing robotic insect spies. I've been seeing these things for at least 5 years, five, six, 7 years myself. Yeah, it's actually, no, 2007. That was right around the time I saw that big crazy robo-moth thing I was telling you guys about. Official denials and suggestions from entomologists that they were actually dragonflies failed to quell speculation, and Tom Earhart, a retired Air Force colonel and expert on unmanned aerial craft, told the Daily Telegraph at the time that America can be pretty sneaky. The following year, the U.S. Air Force unveiled insect-sized spies as tiny as bumblebees that could not be detected and would be able to fly into buildings to photograph, record, and even attack insurgents and terrorists. Around the same time, the Air Force also unveiled what it called lethal mini-drones based on Leonardo da Vinci's blueprints for his Ornithopter flying machine and claimed they would be ready to roll out by 2015. That announcement was 5 years ago, and since the U.S. military is usually pretty cagey about its technological capabilities, it raises the question as to what it's keeping under wraps. The University of Pennsylvania's GRASP lab recently showed off drones that swarm a network of 20 nano quad rotors flying in synchronized formations. The swarm's goal is to combine swarm technology with bio-inspired drones to operate with little or no direct human supervision in dynamic, resource-constrained adversarial environments. However, it is most likely the future of hard-to-detect drone surveillance will mimic Mother Nature. Research suggests that the mechanics of insects can be reverse-engineered to design midget machines to scout battlefields and search for victims trapped in the rubble or fly around your house looking for grow lights, which is what they're more commonly going to be used for, I'm sure. Nanobiomimicry MAV design has long been studied by DARPA, and in 2008, the U.S. government's military research agency conducted a symposium discussing bugs, bots, Borgs, and bioweapons. Researchers have now developed bio-inspired drones with bug eyes, bat ears, bird wings, and even honeybee-like hairs to sense biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons. And the U.S. isn't the only country to have poured money into spy drone miniaturization. France has developed flapping wing bio-inspired micro drones. The Netherlands Biomav developed a parrot drone last year, which is now available in the U.S. as a flying video game. Zoologist Richard Bomefree of Oxford University has concluded research to generate new insight into how insect wings have evolved over the last 350 million years. I got to say, what pisses me off the most about this is these guys need to use this shit for whatever they want. But when, you know, regular citizens start using these things for what they want, oh, no, they have a problem with that, and they make it illegal. You can't do that. And I think that's what I think as soon as this technology is becoming more and more available, I think this is one of those, I talked about technology and how we need to use it. And I see this, you know, I don't see this as fear of, you know, you got to be looking over your shoulder to see if they're going to send one of these drones in or not. But I personally think that this is a great opportunity for, you know, as this technology continues to get better and cheaper and more readily available, you know, if they're going to put this stuff on us and keep watching us all the time, I say we start using these miniature drone technologies to watch these guys. You know what I mean? Seriously, I mean, you know, everybody talks about these elite guys like they're fucking, you know, Anunnaki aliens in ivory towers or something. These guys are fucking accessible, dude, and they will drop from a knife to the throat like anybody will. Okay? These guys aren't gods. They're humans like the rest of us. But my point is, you know, people like David Rockefeller and stuff like that, are, I mean, they're out in the public. You know, you can see him walking out of his house. But wouldn't it be great if you know, every time David Rockefeller got to gun, you know, to leave his house to go down to the CFR meeting or something, he's got some little fucking drone. Hey, David Rockefeller, you cocksucker, we're watching you. We've got you on the webcam, motherfucker. You're streaming live. You cocksucking bastard. You're not going to get away with this. We've got drones on you, Rockefeller. Yeah. We're watching your ass take a shit right now outside the window. I got a drone out there. Put like a live feed of my voice on it in a loudspeaker. Wouldn't that be killer? But really, I mean, I think that's what we ought to do with this technology. You start to fucking, you know, using against them. Remember the pizza or the taco shank that tried to do it and they shut them down? They wouldn't let them do it. That's bullshit. Come on. These guys get to fly these drones around everywhere and spy on you for going to a protest or, you know, smoking a joint at a concert or something. You know, you want to have the right. You do have the right, if the technology is available to you, to turn this motherfucker right back on the oppressors. So it's gonna be fun to watch this play out, because I think that's the best logical solution for this. You know, they start flying little mini drones around us. We get our hands on them. We start flying them around. They'll get a little agitated with it after a while. You know, every time some fucking crony tries to go down and get a latte, he's got some, you know, some fucking drone with a camera on it buzzing. He'll get tired of that eventually. Man, there is something going on with this. And I've been saying this for the past couple of years, these cases where we've had, and there's been multiple now, people on the air, on TV, just going into jabber talk for no reason. And people have speculated that it's everything from, you know, the electronic camera equipment, which I don't buy because in some cases this didn't happen in TV studios. It's happened, you know, in the newest case, it happened right here in my own backyard. Texas Rangers TV play-by-play man Dave Barnett had a bizarre on-air moment in the eighth inning of the game between Rangers and San Diego Padres on Monday night. During a break in play, the veteran broadcaster claimed the go-ahead run was at fifth and rambled on about a botched robbery and something about henchmen. His microphone was cut off for a few moments, then he returned to finish the game. And I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, The Core. You know, a cheesy, shitty movie where they go to reset the Earth's core and stuff. It's got old horse teeth in it. Hillary Swank. Well, she's old horse teeth too, Electric Boogaloo. The original old horse teeth is Julia Roberts, but, you know, she's the 2.0 version of old horse teeth. Not to be confused with the other old horse teeth, but she's old horse teeth Junos. That's Sarah Jessica Parker. Horse teeth Junos. That's what we call her. Hey, look, it's Horse Teeth Junos, your favorite. She's on TV. Yeah, she's probably fucking some dude, besides Matthew Broderick, because he's gay. Anyway, several times this has happened, where people just start talking gibberish. Remember fucking, what's his name? Stalin, Mad Money Kramer. He just said, and this, that, and Lehman Brothers, and, you know, the Bavarian Illuminati, the Queen of England, the Trilateral Commission are not half bad. Everybody's like, what? Excuse me? But in that movie, The Core, that happens. People just start, because the Earth's magnetic field starts going crazy, people start just talking gibberish for no real reason. It's very bizarre. But this has happened so many times now, something's going on with this. I mean, how long have we been shooting TV programs and news and stuff like that? All of a sudden, people are just having strokes on camera and saying gibberish, but it's all just a coincidence? This is happening now for a reason, and they're covering this up, where they know damn well why this is happening. But they're covering this up because whatever it is, well, you know, it's got to be some serious shit. Prescription painkillers have topped car accidents as the leading cause of accidental death in the U.S. Boy, you're crazy if you take those fucking pills, man. I got to tell you, I've had friends, relatives, you know, girlfriends. I mean, I've seen people go down bad roads on these prescription pills, man. And, I mean, I don't take anything. I hardly ever even take a fucking aspirin unless I have to. But you're just, I mean, these things are designed to kill like every other drug. I mean, people, that's the thing is that we've allowed this. There are so many people out there now that think that, you know, smoking pot is bad and smoking cigarettes is bad, but drinking alcohol and taking pills is acceptable because those things are quote unquote legal. And this has caused a disconnect where people don't even know how dangerous these prescription drugs are. And let me tell you here, if it doesn't matter what it is. From prescription drugs to chemotherapy to radiation, doesn't matter. These are barbaric and brutal devices that are not intended to heal the body, but they're intended to kill it and destroy it. That's unbelievable. We have now surpassed car wrecks as the leading cause of death in this country. Prescription painkiller overdose. It doesn't surprise me because I've known, you know, I've seen a lot of people go down the road, man. Seen a lot of death from it. You know, I thank my lucky stars that I never got into that. So I tell you what, though, I do know what, I can't say I know what it feels like, but I do know what it feels like in a small way. One time it was actually during the, when I think it was it then? I'm pretty sure it was then. Yeah, my dad hadn't had cancer, not gotten cancer the first time that long. This is 2007. It was when 9/11 New World Rising first came out, and I was, William Rodriguez had made me, you know, the last guy who's pulled out of the World Trade Center alive. He had made me his official cameraman for the day at my movie premiere event we were having where he was speaking in 2007. And we were at the Lakewood Theater in Dallas, and it was kind of dark in there, and they had just small lights on the stage where he's getting filmed or interviewed for Telemundo. And I was on the edge of the stage. I was about to go outside, and I jumped off the stage. I didn't realize it was a lot farther down off the stage than it was. It was dark in there. And when I hit the bottom, I twisted my ankle really fucking bad, and it hurt. And the next day was a Rush concert that I was going to. So I was like totally fucking, plus I had, you know, I had to work too and go to my job or whatever. And so my dad had given me some of his pain pills, and he gave me like a week's worth, you know. And that's about how long I was in pain for, a week or so. I was, you know, I was good to go. Wouldn't really hurt that much anymore. But I noticed it after I had taken these things for pain for a week, after like the, you know, after I'd taken them all, I started feeling like my stomach was hurting, like somebody was stabbing me in the stomach with a knife. And I was like, oh, it takes that quick, dude. Sometimes not even that quick. I mean, that was a week. But they were already, I think they were hydrocodones or something like that. That's what they were, hydrocodone. And those are big time. People get hooked on those motherfuckers. Bad. Bad, 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 bad. They get hooked on those because that's what they do to you. They get you chemically addicted. But anyway, yeah, dude, for about 3 or 4 days or almost 3 or 4 or 5 days after that, every day my stomach hurt and it felt, and my body was telling me that it wanted more. And I just had to cold turkey myself off of it. And since then, I hadn't taken anything. I hadn't had any reason to take any of that stuff. But, man, you know, a lot of people just, they'll do these prescription drugs because, you know, it's recreational. And they, you know, there's this illusion that some, you know, they come from a doctor, so they must be safe. You know. But that's what people who talk about the drug war and all this stuff, you know, they never factor that in. That what the medical industrial complex, who of course is owned by Chase Manhattan Bank. Chase Manhattan Bank has had offices inside of all the major medical supply companies throughout the world for years and years and years, decades. No surprise that it's the bankers who have the most invested in this medical industrial complex. And of course, that never gets factored in. You know, people talk about how many people are addicted to heroin or coke or whatever it may be, but there's this thing where people, it's a socially acceptable thing, and they never factor in just how much money is being made off the death and destruction of people under the guise of you know, oh, it's medicine, it's okay. And I could talk about that all night, but I just, if you are somebody out there and you're addicted to these prescription pills, oxycodone, any of those things, you don't have to be addicted. It doesn't always have to go that way. You can get off of them if you want to. It's not going to be easy, but it's going to be worth it in the long run. And yes, you're probably going to have to, you know, be in a position where you're going to look like a junkie for a while. You know, and you're just going to have to be straight up with people and say, look, yeah, you know, I'm trying to get off these pills. But you got to do it the same way you do when you try to get off heroin. You got to kick it, and you're going to have to go to the methadone clinic, and you're going to have methadone treatments every day so your body can slowly wean off of it. Because once it gets you, man, you don't have any other choice. You have to slowly wean yourself off of it with slower and smaller and smaller dosages of the methadone. But you can beat it, and it is worth it. And if you are in a situation where you're addicted to these things, let me say this to you. And I know that no matter what we do, you know, I've talked about this before, like, you know, people brought up, well, why do you use PayPal? That guy supports Ron Paul, you know, and I just say, well, you know, yeah, that may be true, but everything, and it is pretty much true, everything you know, everything in the end goes back to these guys. It all goes back to them in the end. But what I'm saying with these, you know, the only way that this is ever going to not be a problem is with people when they run out of customers. And that's my biggest thing. We need to quit giving these guys customers. They need to quit giving these drug companies customers. And they hate losing a customer, and they want to try ways to get those customers back. So if you're, you know, if you have a problem with those type of things and you're trying to fight the good fight against these guys, you know, don't give them any ammo for their war coffers by continuing to buy and consume their prescription poison. Well, that's all the news we have for tonight. I told you it was slight, man. It's been smaller and smaller. The good thing is I've got lots of books lined up. That's the good thing. I'm just going to keep on doing it this way for the time being. I mean, I'm sure at some point it'll pick up and be plenty more stuff to cover, but like I said, the great thing is I've got more, and I've got a lot of books on standby. I think I've already got at least the next two or three picked out already, which is just awesome. And I think we were about a little more than halfway through the current book we're reading. So we'll get more into that for you here tonight. We have just a few hours left on our emergency film budget. Please help us out there if you can. 20 hours. We've got $2,000 or so to go. And you can go back and listen to Monday night's show and listen to the listing I gave there for different amounts. Donate certain amounts. And 50 or more get you a signed DVD with priority delivery. 100 or more get you a signed DVD, special thanks in the credits. 500 more get you a signed DVD, priority shipping, co-producer, film the credit, and a special gift from me. And 2,000 more. Now, if somebody could come in and be the executive producer level right now for 2,000, you get all that, including a special gift pack from me. And also, don't forget that any donation over $50 is going to get you in the drawing at the end of the month for the Global Reality All Stars. We'll announce all our Global Reality All Stars of the week on the show Friday. And at the end of the month, we'll have the drawing for this month's prize. for the new thing we're doing for any donation. If you make it toward the film, if you make it towards operating costs, doesn't matter. But you can't have more than two a week. Okay. You can donate $50 one day and $50 another day, and you can get two entries that week. You can't get more than two. Otherwise it's not going to be fair. You know, otherwise whoever makes more donations, somebody else has more chances. We're not going to do it like that. So anyway, TheGlobalReality.com. Please help us out there if you can. We're going to take a break, come back, and continue our series of reading for you here tonight on the show. This is The Global Reality right here on The Global Reality Radio Network with me, your host, Josh Reeves. Stay with us. I hate when that happens. Come on. Why are you stuttering and stammering here? God. There we go. All right, stay with us, folks. We'll be back. Thank you.
uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
All right, back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reese. Thanks for being with us here tonight. We are going to be continuing our series of reading The Lost Worlds of Ancient America. And we left off last time in the middle of a chapter concerning Ecuador and some of the various pottery and out-of-place things there, right in line with everything else we've been discussing and right in line with everything else I've been researching for this film. So we're going to continue on where we left off right now. Later discoveries at Valdivia site showed that the chronology proposed by Meggers, Evans, and Estrada may have been incorrect. Estrada thought similarities with Joan pottery are more characteristic of the Valdivia B period. Also, a pre-Valdivia pottery was discovered, and a new chronology has since been established that puts Valdivia A in a category called Valdivia 2. Valdivia 1 refers to a previously undescribed occupation with early ceramics. The situation has become more complex, and thinking about the Japan-Ecuador connection has changed during recent years. The discovery of possible Japanese artifacts dated to about 500 BC at another site in Ecuador was reported by Estrada that suggests a more complex lineage between Japan and Ecuador than was previously imagined. Also, some artifacts similar to those of the Han Dynasty China, about 200 BC, were also found in this small country. Records show that the ancient Chinese did know of a land to the east, and they even had a name for it, Fusang. Chinese voyages in this direction are believed to have occurred in 219, 210, and 100 BC and 500 AD. A fleet of boats carrying some 3,000 people, funded by the emperor and led by a man called Hsu Fu, was known to have sailed to Fusang in 219 BC. They never returned. Another interesting piece of information supportive of an Ecuador-Japan connection is biological. The human T-cell leukemia virus, HTLV-1, has its highest occurrence in Japan. In South America, its existence is restricted to the Andes. This fact, the lack of decisive data, and the complexities of establishing pottery horizons have not been enough to change the trend in mainstream archaeology to seek indigenous causes for cultural development. There is no doubt that coastal Ecuador and the Guayas Basin have been occupied since very early times. The formative period in Ecuador, which includes the Valdivia culture, was centered in this region. The Machalila and the Corira style of pottery, a 1500 to 1000 BC, produced just to the north of this region, had a tremendous influence on distant cultures, including those in Mexico, Guatemala, and Peru. More recently, between 500 BC and 500 AD, the urban Bahia culture flourished. The earliest metalwork in the New World began about this time in Ecuador. Later, the Matino culture bearers, who were said to be excellent sailors, inhabited the region. Ecuador was not a backwater to Peru in ancient times. It was a thriving center of human activity and apparently an exporter of culture. The Gulf of Guayaquil itself may have been an important feature for ancient navigators. It has been suggested by Gunnar Thompson that this geographical feature is actually noted on a number of European pre-Columbian maps. If this is so, it implies that ancient voyagers from the west were able to reach this part of South America. Thompson also suggests that the ancient Inca city of Cajamarca, just south of the Gulf of Guayaquil, may have been the Catigara on ancient Roman maps that was located in the biblical land of Ophir. There is certainly something of a match between the Ecuadorian coastline and a mysterious body of land shown on the Divergia map of 1414, though it could likewise be said that this body of land may refer to the northern part of Australia. As already mentioned, it is also possible that this ancient voyagers from China or Southeast Asia reached the South American coast, perhaps as recently as the 15th century. Until recent times, these peoples were ahead of the West in the development of watercraft and navigational techniques, including the use of the compass. As Thor Heyerdahl long ago demonstrated, navigating the Pacific is most easily done by using the powerful Japanese and Humboldt currents. Ocean travelers coming from China or Japan would utilize the Japanese current, which would take them to the North American West Coast by a route that runs north of Hawaii and south of Alaska. Though this might seem like a roundabout way to reach America, is actually shorter than sailing due east from China or Japan. The curvature of the globe is such that real distances are difficult to grasp on a two-dimensional map, particularly a Mercator projection. On reaching the American coast, navigation further south would be more difficult, but possible. Near the equator in particular, the currents and winds are more complex and subject to changes. Ocean travelers leaving South America and heading west would utilize the Humboldt current, which is easily reached from Peru and Ecuador. As Heyerdahl himself proved, it is possible to sail from South America to the Polynesian Islands and beyond. Aside from the Valdivia pottery and possible trans-Pacific contacts, Ecuador has other surprises and a long history much covered by colonial and modern construction. Cuneca, one of Ecuador's largest cities, is just the latest settlement in an area that had a very long history. It was built over an Incan city called Tumbaba, which was completely destroyed. And its heyday was said to have rivaled Cusco in its grandeur. Tumbaba itself was built over a major Canary city, the Canary being the native Ecuadorian Indians who held back the expansionistic Incas for decades. Architectural remnants of these ancient native cultures exist in the region, though they are not very visible, and Spanish clergymen bent on Christian conversion made the natives outsiders in their own land. One exception was Father Crespi of Cuenca. Now, this is, Now, I was hoping they were, I was reading this, I was going, man, are they going to get into Father Crespi? Because I hope they do, because Nikola Tesla, one of our listeners, he and I were looking at some things in the chat room last week, and he'd post himself, and he was saying, man, look at this picture. It's, you know, this stuff's right in line with your research, and I had never seen these artifacts before, and I was like, where the hell is this coming from? You know, where the hell are you getting this stuff? I've never seen these artifacts. And then I started reading in one of the links that he had posted in there, and I said, oh, shit, this is some of Father Crespi's stuff. And I had never seen any of the pictures of any of the artifacts that he had found because I think, I can't remember the whole story. I think it was on Ancient Aliens or one of those shows. So you might be able to watch one of those and see the story. Because I'm kind of bastardizing it here. I'm going from memory. But from what I can recall, Father Crespi had helped out some of these indigenous people, and they didn't have medical care. These are bush tribesmen, you know. And sometimes some of their people would get hurt. And Father Crespi would, you know, help fix them up. And in exchange for helping to fix him up, they would bring him these artifacts. And at one time, he had a huge collection of these. And then after he died, of course, the Vatican confiscated them all. But one of the pictures is this picture of this indigenous Indian-looking guy. And I just posted it in the chat room. And he's holding the head of a bearded giant. Now, allegedly, these came from this cave in Ecuador that you had to dive under this water to get to, and nobody still knows the location of it, allegedly, but there was all these kind of artifacts like this. Like, I mean, this is obviously showing what I found in my research, just crystal clear. This story of these, natives slaughtering these giants. And that picture right there in particular that I just dropped in the chat room, I've got two, actually, that come from the Father Crespi collection. But that one, my goodness gracious. I had not seen that one. And seeing that, I mean, it was like a bucket of cold water, man. Because, you know, I've found this information in my research. And then to see that there's an artifact on this, like, you know, bronze plate or some kind of metal plate, it just absolutely floored me. I couldn't believe it. I was like, my goodness, you know. And then there's another one here of what appears to be some sort of serpent priest. He's definitely a priest of some kind. You can tell by his markings. And there's a serpent in the sky behind him. And these were both startling, and also there's a codex, some sort of language codex, in a grid pattern on the bottom of where this priest is standing. It's some kind of language, some kind of codex. You could tell by looking at it, it's clearly that it's some sort of codex. What it means and what it is, I don't know. But, you know, there he is. This is, in my opinion, depicting some sort of Atlantean serpent priest. I think this is absolutely the remnant of some Atlantean culture. No question about it. But, I was hoping they were going to get into Father Crespi here. So let's get into that now. I just had to drop those pictures in there in case nobody had seen those, because they absolutely blew me away. One exception was Father Crespi of Cuneca. He was a friend to the local Indians who repaid his kindness and concern for them with gifts of archaeological artifacts that they reportedly found in deserted cities and deep tunnels to the east of Cuneca. Throughout the years, Father Crespi's collection came to include large pieces of hammered sheet metal with highly sophisticated engravings, sculptures that are clearly reminiscent of the ancient Near East, and curious objects that are difficult to place in the context of ordinary archaeology. He was presented with artifacts with images of llamas, bronze Phoenician calendars. There we go. That's how I know for a fact that we know who we're talking about now, because Amorites, Canaanites, Phoenicians, they were all derivations of each other. The Hittites as well were also a part of that clan. Calendars, pyramids, and enigmatic inscriptions, and even the engraving of a dinosaur. There were also metal and stone mechanical devices, bronze air pipes, and woven copper with radiator-like objects. Author Richard Wingate photographed a portion of Crespi's extraordinary collection and published some of the photos in his book, Lost Outpost of Atlantis. Lost Outpost of Atlantis. Okay. Hold on a second. I just had to make a note of that. That sounds like a book I need to get, so yeah, I had to type that in real quick. Father Crespi was known to have accepted these gifts, many of which were obvious fakes, from hungry Indians whom he fed his, obvious fakes, right? Well, how would you ever know? See, that's what they can claim they were obvious fakes or whatever else, because that's what they do every time they find an artifact that doesn't fit in with their archaeological knowledge. They say it's fake, even though just like the footprints they found. Oh, those are fake. Right. His mission was one of compassion, not science. Unfortunately, this approach, combined with his eccentricities, worked against the credibility of his collection. No professional archaeologist would get involved with analyzing these clearly contaminated and untraceable artifacts. Even worse, in 1962, his museum was partially destroyed in an arsonist's fire. The remains of his collection are now owned by the Central Bank of Ecuador. I love that. Don't you love that? I love that. These are fakes. They're nothing to them. They're lies. They're crap. Any self-respecting archaeologist wouldn't even dare look at these artifacts. They're junk, but oh, by the way, they're now in possession of the Central Bank of Ecuador, right? But the Central Bank of Ecuador just puts worthless things in their vaults. I mean, they put money in there, it's worthless, but you know. That's just too funny. Go figure, it was in a bank. But I had heard that some of them had been confiscated by the Vatican as well. In conversation with a private collector at Cuneca, I learned that Crespi was locally regarded as someone duped by the Indians, right? Because nobody could believe that these things that they were pulling out of here could have the archaeological context they do. But see, I know for a fact now that his collection was not lies, because I have the proof that these ancient Middle Eastern guys, these giants, these men of great stature, were not only in North and South America, folks, they were all over the entire planet. And it is a fact. He wanted to believe the artifacts they gave him were proof to Ecuador's earliest cultures ever in contact with others from the ancient Mediterranean world. He believed that the Amazon was a transportation route between these two worlds and that the artifacts came from an undiscovered prehistoric city on the eastern side of the Andes. Aside from his own collection, Crespi would point to the resemblance between Valdivia Venus figurines and ancient Egyptian figurines known as Shabakatis. It is true that these two categories of artifacts share similar treatments. Despite the questionable nature of many of Crespi's artifacts, they at least raise the question of travel from the Atlantic to the Pacific movement over the Amazon basin, over the Andes, to the Pacific via mostly waterways, from which were possible at several places in the north of South America. One is up the huge Amazon River to one of several rivers that drain the highlands. From these rivers, the Napo, Pataza, and Santiago, is only about 100 miles up and over the highlands to the Guayaquil region. A combination of waterway and land crossings through Ecuador to the Pacific is also possible from the Caribbean. Near the city of Cartagena, the rivers Cuaca and Magdalena, where the oldest pottery in Colombia is found, can be followed south almost to the Ecuadorian border. From there, one can follow the avenue of the volcanoes down to the Pacific near present-day Guayaquil. There was a well-traveled route in ancient times, and there are other intriguing speculations about Ecuador and cultural diffusionism. A recent book on Mesoamerican calendrics presents a case for the origins of Mesoamerican culture on the Pacific coast near the ancient city of Izapa. This region, called Soconusco, today's Chiapas, and in the general vicinity of the Mexican-Guatemalan border, is characterized by abundant wildlife, fertile soils, and an extreme diversity of habitat. Vincent Malmstrom, the author, argues that this is the only comfortably habitable stretch of land along the Pacific coast north of Ecuador. In between are inhospitable mangrove forests. Archaeological evidence dates the earliest significant cultural developments in the Soconusco to about 1800 BC. Around this time, the people living there were farming, building large houses on raised mounds, and making elaborate pottery. It's interesting. They had mounds there. Somebody had come and seeded them with culture. They had pottery-making abilities and mound-building abilities. It's funny how that always goes hand-in-hand, isn't it? About 1500 BC, it appears that newcomers arrived in the Soconusco region by sea, and the native pottery styles began to change and evolve rapidly. Eventually, the Soconusco culture moved north and east across the Tehuantepec Gap between the Oaxaca and Chiapas Highlands to establish the early Mesoamerican sites identified as Olmec. That's where the giant stone balls are found, Olmecs. Malmstrom argues that the most significant innovations of the Soconusco culture are to be found in their astronomy and calendars. According to him, Soconusco is the place of origin for the 260-day astrological calendar, a key component of the Mayan calendar. Malmstrom and others have suggested that voyagers from Ecuador may have significantly influenced Mesoamerican civilization in their explorations up and down the Pacific coast around 1500 BC. Similarities in ceramics, burials, clothing, metallurgy, and the distribution of dogs and jays have been cited as evidence for possible links between Ecuador and Mexico's geography. Malmstrom's field is also an important argument for him. He points out that it is only north of the western point of the Ecuadorian coast that the equatorial countercurrent sweeps northward along the coast of Central America, reaching as far as Soconusco. He also notes that balsa trees for making rafts were far more available from the huge Guayas River than from the banks of the small desert rivers that empty into the Pacific along the shoreline of Peru. In his view, it may have been Ecuadorians, as carriers of the earliest Andean cultures, who stimulated the development of high civilization in Mesoamerica. A single carving on a wall of the ball court at the ruins of Izapa, a major site in Soconusco, holds an interesting image that suggests that the area's contact with seafarers was an important part of their heritage. This enigmatic image suggests that outside contact may have not been limited to Ecuadorians on rafts. It represents a bearded man in a sea boat with outstretched arms holding a cross of some sort. And this, again, this is why, this is even, this is before the conquistadors, before any of that stuff. And, you know, there's that artifact that Father Crespi had with the guy holding the giant's head and with bearded giant. And, these are the guys that gave them culture. And some of them were, you know, nice, and some of them were not so nice. And, unfortunately, they didn't differentiate between the ones that were nice and the ones that weren't. They just slaughtered them all. And later on, when the conquistadors and the Spanish and all this showed up, they bowed to them and acted as if they were their gods, because this is what they had beards, and this is what they expected their gods to look like. So they thought their gods were returning, and you know the rest. They got fucking slaughtered for that. There is no question that ancient South Americans set out into the Pacific Ocean on rafts. These rafts, called balsas, were made of huge balsa logs arranged so that the central log was the longest, with the others flanking it, laid in decreasing length, creating the effect of a prow. A wooden cabin in a bipod mast for a sail set atop the main logs. Boards shoved between the logs served as small keels, allowing the raft to sail at an angle to the winds. Bartolomeu Ruiz, one of Pizarro's pilots on a reconnaissance voyage south of Panama to the equator, reported sighting a native raft 100 miles off the coast in 1526. The raft, about as big as a ship, was carrying 20 well-dressed natives and about 30 tons of cargo. The raft was also sailing against the current. Ruiz had 11 natives thrown overboard, took 3 women to be trained as translators, and let the rest go free. Long-distance balsa raft navigation was an Ecuadorian tradition. Spanish historians recorded an interesting story about a voyage led by the Incan Tupac Yapacuani. He was, at the time, engaged in conquering Ecuador, specifically the regions along the Gulf of Guayaquil, and had heard stories from seafaring merchants of lands to the west, lands that he wanted to add to the Incan Empire. Tupac Yupanqui apparently set sail with 20,000 men on a flotilla of rafts in search of 2 distant populated islands, supposedly rich in gold. His expedition was gone for perhaps a year. The Inca did return with some metal and prisoners. Some think his voyage took him to the Galapagos, and others suggest that he had reached Easter Island. Thor Heyerdahl challenged academic resistance to the idea of the feasibility of ancient voyages by doing them himself, and went to Ecuador for logs to build his raft. After felling huge balsa trees on a tributary of the Guayas, he floated them downstream to Guayaquil and then had them shipped to Peru, where they were assembled. Heyerdahl modeled Contiki after rafts constructed by the Matino, a coastal Ecuadorian people known as excellent seafarers. The tradition of balsa raft navigation in Ecuador was made possible by both the abundance of balsa trees in the region and the nearby powerful ocean currents. Heyerdahl himself believed that the Guayas region of Ecuador and northern Peru was the midpoint of ancient America maritime activity. It was certainly a center for commerce, as observed by the first Spaniards who sailed into the region. They found huge rafts loaded with tons of products sailing, not drifting, miles offshore. Reports of distant traders who came to the port of Zacutula in western Mexico were sent to the king in 1525. Interestingly, this harbor is at the mouth of the Rio Balsas. These distant traders apparently remained at the port for months at a time before they attempted a return. This is evidence in the form of pre-Columbian ceramic remains of routine 600-mile voyages to the Galapagos Islands. It is certainly possible to sail great distances on seaworthy balsa rafts. Since Heyerdahl's famous Contiki voyage in 1947, many other researchers have successfully sailed the Pacific Ocean on balsa rafts. In 1969 and 1973, Vital Alsar led voyages that began in Ecuador and reached Australia. In spite of all this, Western archaeologists, historians, and alleged experts on the peopling of Polynesia have emphatically resisted accepting any suggestions that ancient South Americans were capable of such voyages. Some responded to Heyerdahl's voyage by saying he only proved that Norwegians are good sailors. The more one studies the ancient history of Ecuador, the more one realizes its importance as both a long-distance sailing center and a point of cultural diffusion. Ecuadorian pottery alone suggests that in very early times, the region may have been a major origin point in the New World from which culture spread. If so, it was probably diffused more by sea than by land. Some mainstream archaeologists are at least beginning to consider the possibility that the Olmec culture, the earliest civilization in Mesoamerica, was jump-started by ancient Ecuadorian trading voyages and that later Mesoamerican cultures benefited from repeated contact with distant traders. Whether or not voyagers from other continents reached Ecuador regularly in ancient times is still open to question, though evidence suggests that there may have been at least some contacts with ancient Japan and possibly also the Han Dynasty of China. Whether or not ancient Mediterranean travelers sailed up the Amazon to trade with early cultures of Ecuador and Peru is more questionable. Well, I think they found a statue from the Han Dynasty or somewhere around that time in a well in fucking Oklahoma. Some old lady found it in her well. So, yeah, there were definitely some, ancient Asians here. This week on the History Channel, you've heard of ancient aliens. Now, the new cutting-edge series from the History Channel, Ancient Asians. We have reason to believe that there were Asians involved in the first Hanukkah. One thing for certain is that Ecuador, where it was the first conquest of where Peru began, when Pizarro sailed into the Gulf of Guayaquil, he encountered civilization in South America. At the southern end of the Gulf, he found Tumbes, the gateway to the kingdom of the Incas and the point from which the conquest of the Inca Empire began. Strangely enough, this may have been the same place where an earlier and probably more benign influence on Andean civilization began as well. A Peruvian legend recalled that long ago, bearded gods had arrived on these shores. In these two instances, one history and the other legend, coastal Ecuador was indeed a point of contact. As mainstream archaeologists continued their efforts to reconstruct South American prehistory, they will no doubt find the Ecuador's cultural role in pre-Columbian times was wider and more complex than previously assumed. That's the end of chapter 26. Chapter 27 is entitled The Stone Towers of Japan and Easter Island. Now, Easter Island's been in the news a lot lately because, well, first of all, they were doing more excavations. They were saying, oh my God, Easter Island now has hands. It has, the heads at Easter Island, they have hands, they have arms. And I was just going, my God, you people, are you dense? Did you know how to fucking read? Some of us have known that for fucking decades. I remember hearing about that when I was a kid. And now recently they're coming and saying, oh, they have hands and arms. And see, for years, the story's been the way they did. They carved them on one side of the island, and they rolled them with logs across the other side of the island. But the problem with that is that that's been attempted multiple times, and they it can't be done. And now there was a story. I didn't cover it. It was in the news today, but to me it was retarded. It wasn't worth covering, but I'll mention it here. And now they're saying it was done by ropes, and they made them dance, and they wobbled them side by side with ropes to get them. It's just total horseshit, man. They weren't used with any modern conventional things. They were either used with sound frequency vibrations or mental ability, telekinesis, that kind of thing. It's amazing to continue to see the bullshit that is being spread about these ancient sites to fall right back in line with the old way of thinking. So anyway, next time on the show, chapter 27, The Stone Towers of Japan and Easter Island. Getting into that next time on the show. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. And looks like we have about 19 hours, I guess, left on the Bird's Eat Film chip-in budget. We got about $2,000 to go. Please help us out if you can. We got different price points for people there with different things you donate. But $50 or more is going to get you a signed DVD. Do the math on that. So please help us out if you can. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. My name is Josh Reeves, and I love each and every one of you. And we will see you next time for the broadcast. You guys have yourselves a great night, great day. Take care.